I want to introduce our keynote speaker, who is Jason Karlowish, a geriatrician and bioethicist from the University of Pennsylvania, who I think quite literally put the issue of voting by people with cognitive impairments associated with dementia on the policy agenda. By describing a little bit about what he has done, I think it also sets the kind of immediate backdrop for this conference. After the 2000 election, he did a short interview study with caregivers for 75 patients in the memory clinic at Penn to ascertain whether patients with mild to moderate dementia had voted, and found that a considerable number had voted. This piece was published in the journal Neurology in 2002 and got some attention. Building on that foundation, Jason then obtained a grant from the Greenwald Foundation to explore the ethical, legal, and social issues that are raised by voting by people with dementia, and assembled a group of stakeholders and experts, including advocates for older persons like the AARP and other persons with disabilities. At the core of this effort was also were participants from the American Bar Association's Commission on Law and Aging, which is directed by Charles Sabatino, who is the lead speaker in the afternoon session. Some of the research produced by the Greenwald Project and under Jason's leadership and tutelage is displayed on the website and outside on the table. In the wake of that project, the American Bar Association then received a grant from the Borchardt Foundation to develop consensus recommendations for addressing the issues that had been identified through the Greenwald Project that Jason headed. A conference was then held at the McGeorge Law School in Sacramento in March of 2007, which produced an important report and some recommendations that were then formally approved by the American Bar Association in August of 2007. And that summary of recommendations is in the packet that you have. And I think if there's one thing that you that you should read that will give you an overview of kind of where we stand and what the vision for change is, it would in fact to be to read that document. The third phase is now underway. A new grant from the Greenwald Foundation and from the Borchardt Foundation has been made to the American Bar Association to stimulate a broader public discussion and to implement and evaluate potential reforms. This conference itself is part of that effort. So I want to now turn the podium over to Jason. Let me also say that we're going to have to make some judgments about the time here. Overall, we've tried to build in formal discussion into the agenda of the conference. We're going to want to try to hold more general discussion with the speakers until the end of the day. If there are particular issues of clarification that come up in the context of any of the presentations, including Jason's, I certainly don't want to suppress that, but we're trying to hold off comments and discussion until later on. Jason?
So, Dean Dukoski, Governor Belisle, I want to thank you for your support for the conference. I also want to thank Richard Bonney and Paul Friedman and Thomas Guterbach and Don Ahern for organizing the conference and for inviting me to speak with you today on voting among citizens who live in long-term care facilities in Virginia. I'm not standing here alone. Several people and organizations have made significant contributions to providing support, advancing scholarship and policy that allows us to be here today. As Richard mentioned, for the past 8 years, a multidisciplinary group has thoughtfully engaged the issue of facilitating voting as people age and moved this issue forward with care and intelligence and dedication. The meeting today here in this room is one more step in that project, and it is a very important step. In addition to Richard Bonney, other people who have participated in this are Charlie Sabatino at the American Bar Association's Commission on Law and Aging, Paul Applebaum at Columbia University, Pamela Carlin, Professor of Law at Stanford University, Secretary of State Deborah Markowitz of Vermont, Sally Hermey at the AARP, and Ed Spurgeon of the Borchardt Foundation. I also want to thank the Greenwall Foundation, which provided the initial support that made this project possible, and also the American Bar Association and Borchardt Foundation for supporting, along with the McGeorge School of Law, the conference that was occurred in March of 2007, facilitating voting as people age, addressing the challenges of cognitive impairment. That conference produced a set of guidelines and papers that are available in an issue of the McGeorge Law Review that was published earlier last year, and you have copies of those guidelines, and they really are kind of the foundation for the conversation we hope to have today about what do you want to do in the state of Virginia. So our conference today is dedicated to exploring voting among residents of Virginia who live in long-term care facilities. Now, I want to presage the end of the day. I expect that by the end of the day today, we have a plan of action to address the challenges faced by elderly voters who live in long-term care facilities. And if we do this, I also expect that at the end of the day, we'll feel like we're at the bottom of a great hill, and we face a very steep climb, and we may even differ on what path, if any path, we should follow to get to the summit of that hill. We're going to feel a little exhausted. But we can't let those challenges and differences distract us from the common bond that brings us here to this conference. And that bond is captured in the first three words of our United States Constitution, which is "We the People." So those three words are simple, they're clear, but they are not precise. Who are we the people? From 1788 to 2008, the answer to that question has changed. And I think we're getting closer to answering this question, and that's why we're here today. We are here in this room participating in the American experiment that started in the 1700s when we said, "We the people." And the history of the United States of America could be summed up as the history of perfecting our answer to this question of who are we the people. It's an inspiring story. The American experiment has tested whether women, immigrants, people who don't hold property, people of color, whether they're part of we the people. And in each case, we have affirmed that they are. But in some of those cases, it was not without struggle, blood, sweat, and tears. But the result of this experiment is that we have steadily shed the notion of thinking of who are the people based on their status, their class, but instead thinking of them simply as individuals. And perhaps one of the most fundamental rights that we the people have is the right to vote. So we have an obligation today to secure this right and to protect it. And so not only do we want to, we need to facilitate access to the vote and ensure integrity of the vote. We want fair and we want honest elections. And so today we face the challenge of voting by older adults, especially older adults with cognitive impairment and older adults who live in long-term care facilities. They are part of we the people. So let me tell you two stories that frame the issues we need to think about and address. On Election Day 2004, my colleague, Dr. John Brusa, in Philadelphia, was visiting a patient of his in the nursing home as part of a routine visit to take care of her. As she lay in her bed, she was in tears of anger and frustration. She wanted to vote, but she couldn't. Her polling place was at a faraway site somewhere else in the city of Philadelphia. She couldn't get there, and she hadn't been able to re-register at her area or apply for an absentee ballot. She couldn't vote. On Election Day in 2007, a candidate for the Philadelphia Council lost by about 220 votes. When the machine count was tallied, he was ahead. He woke up the next morning, and after the absentee ballots were counted, he lost. The papers report that he claims improprieties in how those ballots were administered at several nursing homes. And he's filed suit in federal court on the basis of a violation of the Voting Rights Act, and that court has granted him a hearing, and that case is now underway. Now, what do these two cases tell us? They tell us that elderly voters, especially those who live in long-term care settings, suffer doubly. People decide whether they can vote, and people steal their votes. Today, I'd like to review the issues and set the context for why we're here and the importance of our topic. If you multiply by several thousand the two stories that I just told you, you have our current system in too many states, including this one. This is a system that, with respect to the rights of the residents of long-term care, neither assures that the elections are fair nor that they are honest. Simply put, the decision to leave the current system as it is an unacceptable decision. The size and the scope of the issue of facilitating voting as people age is big, and it is only going to increase. By 2030, the number of Americans who are 65 and older will double from about 35 to 70 million people. and double at a rate that exceeds all other age groups in this country. At the dawn of the 20th century, persons over 65 were about 5% of our population. By 2030, we expect that to be 20%. In 2000, in this state, Virginia, 11% of your Virginia citizens were 65 and older. That will double by 2030. In some states, such as my state, Pennsylvania, about 40% of the population by 2030 will be over 65, nearly half. One of the fastest growing age groups are people over 80. With that background, one of the chief risk factors for losing cognitive function is that leads to disability is advancing age. The older a person is, the more likely that person is to suffer clinically significant cognitive problems. That is, problems with memory and other abilities that are severe enough that they cause difficulties with day-to-day tasks, such as managing finances, driving, choosing a prescription plan. In other words, these people are disabled. Among persons over 80, about 20% have clinically significant cognitive problems. Now, to date, much of the focus on disability and voter rights has addressed disability as a result of sensory and motor impairments, such as blindness or spinal cord injury. But we need to begin to pay attention to cognitive impairment as a cause of disability. And even more complex and, yes, challenging is we need to pay attention to, amongst the elderly, cognitive and physical impairments often occur together. How will we help a person who has cognitive problems register to vote, get to a polling place, and cast a ballot? So let's consider that question in the setting of a nursing home. The number of Americans with cognitive impairments is increasing. Advancing age is a key risk factor for those impairments. And many of these people live in long-term care settings, such as an assisted living facility or a nursing home. Currently, about 1.6 Americans live in nursing homes, and about that as many also live in assisted living facilities. And it's estimated that some point in each older American's life, the chance of spending at least some time in a nursing home is about 1 in 5. Now, while cognitive impairment is prevalent amongst those residents, I want to reiterate a point that Dean Dukoski made. The severity of this impairment varies. It is simply unacceptable to use the label of a diagnosis, whether that is the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease or the syndrome of dementia, to assume that a person can't do something. And simply to say that someone who lives in a nursing home with advanced cognitive impairment betrays the facts when you go to those facilities and measure people's cognitive abilities. Now, in a nursing home and in a long-term care facility in general, like a boarding school, staff have substantial control over residents' day-to-day lives. They have control over what they can do, and as you'll hear later this morning from Paul Friedman and his colleagues, they have substantial control over what they cannot do, and this includes voting. Unfortunately, elections officials have paid limited attention to two key issues: assuring that residents of long-term care facilities have access to the ballot and preventing unscrupulous persons from exploiting that ballot. Among the 50 states, only about 29 of them have some policies to address voter accommodations in long-term care settings. But most of these guidelines are inadequate. They lack proactive steps to register voters. They rely upon the resident to apply for an absentee ballot. They spring into effect when criteria are met, such as how many absentee ballots a facility orders. The majority of states, though, don't even have any guidelines, including this state. So what happens in those settings? So my colleagues and I have done two studies to answer this question of what happens in long-term care settings where there are no guidelines for voting in long-term care. And I especially acknowledge the work that Richard Bonney and Paul Friedman here at the University of Virginia have done on this. So we studied voting in long-term care settings after a hotly contested mayor's race in Philadelphia and after the 2006 Senate election in the state of Virginia. And you'll learn much more later this morning about the results of those studies. Here I want to summarize some of the key findings. We surveyed assisted living facilities and nursing homes after the elections to find out how voting happened in those settings. The key findings of our surveys show that long-term care staff, especially a social worker or an activities director, were in charge of voting, not elections officials. There was substantial and unnecessary variability in registration and voting procedures and in staff attitudes about who can vote. This variability likely disenfranchised voters, that is to say, led to under-enfranchisement. Many facilities reported there were residents who wanted to vote but were unable to vote, largely due to remediable procedural problems such as failure to order ballots, register residents, or being unable to get people to the polls, like the case I told you about from my colleague John Bruza. Much of the voting in long-term care facilities is absentee balloting. And this is kind of balloting that is well recognized as among the principal mechanisms for voter fraud. Most residents needed some assistance with absentee balloting, and typically one person helped them. Typically, it was a staff member at the nursing home. Finally, many facilities reported that the staff assessed whether a resident was capable of voting prior to even giving them a chance to actually try to vote. And the methods they used likely disenfranchised residents who were actually able to vote. I'd like to talk about that last point in greater detail. The most common method staff used to decide whether someone was able to vote was an assessment of their cognitive ability and election-related questions. And here's a quote from one of the people we interviewed. Is this person aware there's an election going on? What's it for? Is it for the mayor, for the president, or whatever? The irony is that a lot of people who are able to vote would also fail this test. Would this resident have the capacity to make an informed decision or just go eeny, meeny, miny, mo? It's pretty subjective on my part. Perhaps the best summary of this research's results and their implications is captured in this quote from one of the interviewees who was reflecting at the end of her survey about her role in the nursing home. The right to vote, she said, is such a basic right. To feel like you're taking that away from someone, particularly if they're borderline, guidelines would help to make sure there are fair, objective applications. Not, I'm sure she's not going to vote for the person I like, so I'm not going to get her to the polling place or help her. You do have quite a bit of power and authority over folks. Go to any quality reference database for news and search under terms like nursing home and election fraud, and you'll find articles like this. Voter fraud is alleged by McHugh. Lori Holman, Inquirer staff writer. Connie McHugh interrupted a bitter campaign against Joe Vignola for city council for the 1st District yesterday to file a complaint with a U.S. attorney alleging voter fraud in South Philadelphia. She claimed that absentee ballots had been registered for at least two people from Our Lady of Good Counsel Center, a Catholic nursing home at 508 Moore Street, after they had died. She also raised questions about 12 others from the same nursing home. You can find lots of those articles, so just find the search for them. Now, whether Connie McHugh's charges are in fact true is not the issue. But the fact that she made these charges illustrate how nursing homes are convenient sites for politicians to fight over the conduct and the outcome of elections that they're involved in. Now, with not only local, but as we saw in Florida in 2000, national elections potentially hanging on the margins of very slim numbers, we cannot ignore the vote in long-term care. So, with this background set, I'd like to turn to the question of what is to be done. Now, I hope you agree with me that to answer that question with nothing is to be done, leave the status quo as it is simply unacceptable. So last year, as you know, the ABA and the Borchardt Foundation convened a national meeting, which resulted in a set of guidelines that you have before you and recommendations. They set out a set of basic principles, and they address four specific issues: voting technology, absentee balloting, capacity in voting, and voting in long-term care facilities. Now, later today, Charlie Sabatino will discuss these in much greater detail. But among these, I'd like to comment briefly on two: capacity and voting in long-term care facilities. First, on the issue of the capacity to vote. This afternoon, Naomi Karp from the American Association of Retired Persons will speak in greater detail on this topic, with particular attention to Virginia. In my remarks, I just want to focus on a few conceptual points. So, the guidelines respect that some states exclude voters who are not competent to vote. In those kind of states, the guidelines set out recommendations for what the standard should be and how it should be operationalized. To prevent unlawful or unfair exclusion from voting, every person should be presumed to have the capacity to vote, and absent a constitutionally adequate adjudication to the contrary, they should be allowed to vote. And it's inappropriate for any population to be screened for their capacity to vote. In brief, the core message here is that if a state feels compelled to exclude voters on the basis of a lack of capacity to vote, it must be a very simple standard, and its enforcement and its interpretation should only be confined to the courts, not to elections officials on election day, not to staff at a long-term care facility. Now, I would expect at this point, many of you, or some of you, are likely thinking that capacity is the core issue. That if we can simply define what it means to be capable of voting and assist those who are capable and divide the capable from the incapable, we will have solved all our issues and we're done. And in my own intellectual journey with the issue of the capacity to vote, as a physician who's focused on cognitive impairment, I was initially of this view. But I have transformed in my thinking from it being what I thought was a core issue to actually being a potential distraction. Some governments, I have learned, do not have a concept of what it means to be capable of voting, and therefore do not set a standard for what it means to exclude someone who's not capable of voting. Canada, Illinois, and Vermont are three such examples. These very different governments have no standard on their books for what it means to be competent to vote. They don't. There's nothing there. Quite simply, if a person wants to vote and they receive assistance with registering and voting if they need it, that person will either vote or they will not vote. They will either make a choice or they will not make a choice. And if they don't make a choice, their vote is spoiled. In this sense, the capacity to vote is ultimately a performative capacity. You either do it because you wanted to do it, or you can't do it because you tried to do it and you couldn't make a choice. The second recommendation of the ABA guidelines concerned voting in nursing homes. Now, in this setting, voting truly captures all the issues and magnifies the consequences of the failure to adequately address them. As I've told you, long-term care facilities are routinely the site of accusations of voter fraud, particularly absentee balloting fraud. And as I've told you, and here again, they are routinely a place where under-enfranchisement occurs. The core solution to maximizing residents' rights and minimizing fraud is to get elections officials into those facilities. In particular, a team of two or more officials to bring the ballots to the residents of the facilities, not simply the residents who have asked for an absentee ballot, but to all the residents who are registered to vote and who want to vote. And then to assist them, if they need assistance, in voting. For those residents who can't leave their rooms, go to their rooms and help them vote. And I've seen this done. I've been to Australia, where mobile polling is a routine, and seen them go to nursing homes and seen them gather the ballots in a common room and then go to the rooms of those residents who can't leave that room. The model here is early voting on the go. By early voting, I mean voting prior to Election Day. This is a practice that is increasingly more common in many states, such as Ohio, New Mexico, and some of the counties in this state of Virginia. And it's sufficiently common that about a third of all votes cast on this election day are expected to be early votes. So if you're going to do early voting, why not do early voting on the go? That is to say, bring that polling place to a place where people have a hard time getting to a polling place. Let me leave you with a message of hope. Change is happening. There are great models and initiatives in certain countries and states. Charlie Sabatino and Ellen Clem at the American Bar Association are taking the lead on a project dedicated to gathering those best practices and initiatives, summarizing them, and then disseminating them to elections officials. This past winter, the United States Senate Select Committee on Aging held hearings on voting rights for older voters and tasked the United States Elections Assistance Commission to take on this issue, and the EAC got to work right away. It just issued a quick start guide for voting in long-term care settings, and Liza Otero from the EAC is here today, and she'll tell you more about their activities this afternoon. The state of Vermont is implementing a study of mobile polling. Secretary of State of Vermont, Deborah Markowitz, has taken the lead in supporting a study of whether mobile polling can bring greater uniformity to voter participation rates and also identify challenges to doing mobile polling and implementing a program. You'll learn more about that this afternoon, and I think it may be a model when we have those results for what you might want to do here in the state of Virginia. So the challenges of voting as people age are real, and some of them are tough. I won't deny that. We can easily get lost in the details, such as funding, staffing, and time. We can worry ourselves to inaction over this issue, but we should not let those details distract us from our mission. I believe that a state that achieves success in facilitating voting for older adults, especially those who live in long-term care facilities, will have created a system for those particular residents that will have substantial benefits, not simply for those older adults, but for all voters in that state. That state will have a well-funded, proactive set of election officials who are well-trained and equipped to maximize the vote and minimize fraud. Your state is just such a state. You can do this. You have a noble tradition of enlightened government. Virginia will move these United States one step closer to perfecting our union of we the people. And it's going to start today. Thank you.